first of all, having gotten past some of the technology woo-ha, let me just say a very good morning to everyone. It's good to be with you all. I get that this is not our first choice in terms of format for a variety of reasons. In fact, I know there are people in the community for whom it doesn't work at all. And I have so appreciated being in touch with people in other ways. I'm truly delighted when people call or email or send homing pigeons or signal fires or like whatever is working these days. It's just really good to be in touch with people. And if this is not what's working for you, then, you know, let's find another way. I would just want to add, I don't want to make this morning about the financial part, but when I hit send on the blurb sometimes, I sort of walk away going, I wonder if I should have said that a little different. And the thing that came back to me in my sort of sleep after I hit send on that one was what I said about us not breaking any records for finances as a community these days. What I meant was year over year, which is sort of the way people tend to be thinking about that stuff these days. How are we doing this year compared to how we were doing last year when the circumstances weren't extraordinary? So in that regard, we're not breaking any records. That we, as a community, sustain this group of exploratory people and that we're able to continue to gather, that I'm able to continue in the role I fulfill in this community, all those things. I think under the circumstances, actually keeping all that going just might be breaking records. So I wanted to kind of recast that sentence, and given that I have the opportunity to do it, I didn't want to pass it up. So thank you is the short version, not just for supporting the community that way, but for supporting the community in every way. There's a lot that happens that's invisible when we gather this way, even less visible perhaps than people pitching in normally. The folks that take care of the website, the folks that continue to help me try to get the video horizontal, the people who do music virtually from their homes, and the folks who contribute by sharing things online. All of that, that's all part of our life as a community right now. So I think that's really important. And I wanted to stop and say, I notice and I appreciate it and I feel really grateful. So thank you. Also want to take a moment to acknowledge that when we gather virtually or otherwise in this part of the world, we do that on Treaty 1 territory. And the homeland of people groups that were here long before anyone from Europe showed up. And we're grateful and we don't take it for granted. And we continue to work at honoring our commitment to being good guests and good human siblings in this place. Also want to take a few moments to breathe together this morning. If you want a focal idea for our breathing together, if you choose to participate in that, then I would suggest people, and the events in Nova Scotia bring this acutely to mind these days, but people that are needing to grieve loss and process trauma and who can't do that in the ways that would typically be the case. They can't do it in person. They can't do it up close. A spontaneous hug might not be on the available options list these days. And that is heartbreak on heartbreak, you know? And so I think if we find ourselves in a circumstance where we have a little bit of energy and breath and care to spare for folks, these next few moments might be a good time to do that. So let's breathe through, if you choose to participate in this, let's breathe through three rounds of in for a count of four and cradle your breath for a count of four and then out for a count of four. Let's do that three times together and know that in ways that we cannot see, we join with not just one another in a moment like that, but with people that are much farther away. And this is what we're learning about the nature of the world in which we live these days, is that we're always exchanging particles with all of it and all of our siblings, all of our other fellow humans and living things. And so let's just kind of keep that in mind while we breathe together. All right. So again, as you wish, if this is not a practice that feels like home to you, then I would say feel free to step away and refill your coffee cup and come right back for ideas. All right, but for now, let's breathe together. All right. Here we go. You know, some mornings, I'm always grateful for that time. And some mornings it feels like I need about another hour of that just to get the monkeys to stop chattering. Anyway, we won't take that now. I won't take that now. I am starting into this Zoom Lessons from the Fourth Century idea this morning with an assumption that I realize might not be true for everyone, which is that our lives now have many more on-screen meetings than they did before this pandemic moved in. My hope is that this Lessons from the Fourth Century idea will have something to say to all of us. So if that initial assumption feels like it sidelines you right from the start, I hope that you can look at it as representative of things in your own life that and unique circumstance that might be parallel, or applicable. And if that's not the case, then as is always the situation in an exploratory community, I would encourage you to just hit stop on this and go in search of what you feel like you need the most. Just don't stop exploring. Don't stop seeking out what keeps your body, mind, and spirit nurtured and striving for balance. One aspect of our exploration today will touch on a symptom that can tell us if things are getting out of whack for us as people, and maybe something that many of us are struggling with by this point in the journey, feeling like we've managed to wrestle some semblance of renewed balance or centeredness out of the circumstances, but that's starting to wear thin. That could be happening. I've had a home-based office for the past couple of decades, as has Corrine, and we've homeschooled our kids as well, and we've lived outside of the city for most of our lives together. So there are ways in which probably the current state of affairs might be impacting us differently than it impacts those who are less accustomed to working from home. That said, I don't think we've been in so many Zoom meetings ever. Some days it really feels like all day is one long series of screen-mediated interactions. And it's a bit strange, you know, to spend the whole day sitting on your butt and hit the end of it feeling exhausted, just feeling kind of uniquely wrung out. And an easy explanation for that feeling might be that whole introvert-extrovert thing, which is sort of an obvious paradigm. The introverts are like, woohoo, and the extroverts are like, oh no, is sort of the simple version. But this situation continues to evolve, and as it goes on, it seems like that really isn't covering it. And lots of folks from everywhere on that particular continuum are starting to feel this way, just kind of uniquely strung out and wrung out. It's becoming common enough that the experts are starting to weigh in. And I can't claim to have made any sort of read the literature broadly on this, but what I have read is intriguing to me, both because of what it has to offer and because of what it seems to either leave out or gloss over. So I'm going to start with what we might call Zoom lessons from the 21st century, which is where most of what's on offer seems to reside. And then I want to move into Zoom lessons from the 4th century, which is where I feel like some of the missing perspectives might be found. So, contemporary lessons first. And my source for this point of view is largely from a BBC article on the subject, which included a fair bit of work from someone named Gianpiero Petriglieri. Oh dear, Petriglieri, there, I knew I could do it. I can only do it once. Petriglieri is an associate professor at INSEAD, INSEAD is one of the world's largest and leading graduate business schools. They've got locations in Europe and Asia and the Middle East and North America. Anyway, what he does is explore sustainable learning and development in the workplace. And so this realm of rapid change is one that intrigues him. And Petroglieri says, I have to say that name very slowly or I won't get it, says that Zoom meetings make us tired for several reasons. And this is interesting stuff, and it's going to lead us somewhere, so just stay with me. Being on a video call, he says, requires more focus than face-to-face, and that means that we're working harder to process nonverbal cues, things like facial expressions, the tone and pitch of the voice, body language. Basically, our minds are together, but our bodies aren't, and we experience that kind of thing as dissonance. So dissonance, another way to describe dissonance is just to say we have conflicted feelings about it, and conflicted feelings are exhausting. So that's sort of that idea. This disconnect of mind and body, that's something we're going to come back to, along with some questions that it raises about the impact of that on our spirit. In our setting at the table, you might experience this aspect of virtual gathering as a kind of internal struggle about what to share or not share on our Facebook page. It's not just you. It's not just a feeling that you have because of some unique aspect of your personality. Basically, we're all missing information. So when we come to a situation like a virtual gathering of community, and we're like, do I want to share this or not? This is a personal thing. We can't look around the room and use all these gauges that we have built into us to sort of go, yeah, I think so. I think today in this room with these people, yes. So we're missing a bunch of information, but we're still trying to make a decision. and that's really hard. This may not be apropos, I'm not sure, but Justin and Michelle, you shared about your farm purchase. Sometimes we have similar emotional experiences when we're making big decisions and we know we don't have all the information. We gather as much as we can, but we know there's pieces missing. That's partly why we experience those kind of decisions as stressful. So this is sort of that in a different form. Another factor, he says, is silence. And this one strikes me as particularly interesting. When we're connecting in person, silence is a normal part of the rhythms of our interactions. And I don't think I was really as acutely aware of this, even as a communicator, until I started editing podcasts from our Sunday morning gatherings. And I listened to how long some of the silences were. And I realized that without people around, just listening to the audio recordings of them, they felt extraordinarily long. And in fact, in some instances, when I'm editing a podcast of a talkie bit, I actually shorten some of the silences. And I didn't know the science behind that. It was an intuitive thing for me. But basically what studies show is that when we're connecting through technology, silence makes us anxious. And it does that because we tend to turn, first of all, in that silence, to our concern that something isn't working, that something about the technology has gone wrong. There's a 2014 study that was published in the International Journal of Human Computer Studies. Anybody read that regularly? Anyway, that study showed that when we're interacting through technology, even delays of 1.2 seconds make people perceive the responder as less friendly or focused. Given some of the glitches that we've experienced with our live streaming endeavors, I think by now I might be perceived as profoundly unfriendly and completely unfocused, as we've had delays of a lot longer than 1.2 seconds. Anyway, the third factor is that the screen in our 21st century experience is a performative environment. We know that everybody's looking at us, and that creates a kind of social pressure to perform. One of the things that I find strangest about all of this is imagining all of you on the other side of the device that I'm talking to. But the device that I'm talking to is just showing me my face. And that's a very odd thing to experience as a human being. And then there's the idea that every video call is a reminder of who we're not getting together with. We're not getting to be with them. We've explored the idea that grief might be associated with our experience of this pandemic. And this can be related to that. Everyone we see on the screen is someone that we can't see in person. And that can feel basically like salt in the wound. That can add to the sting of being cut off and being isolated, not by choice, which would be challenging enough, but because of outside circumstances and outside authorities' assessments of those circumstances and guidelines that are given to us. So a conference call, a Zoom call, a virtual connection can remind us of those things, even if it's not in a conscious way, and we feel that. Well, there's lots more info that's readily available on that, so I'm going to leave it there in terms of the problems. But what to do? Well, the advice that's generally on offer includes, you know, useful pragmatic things like only use the camera when necessary, use audio and phone calls whenever possible, put the screen off to the side because apparently that helps our brain feel like we're in an adjoining room, and that can help our concentration. Who knew we were so easy to trick? That one kind of made me chuckle. We could try exchanging documents with detailed notes instead of firing up yet another Zoom meeting. We should learn to build in transition times and find ways to put aside one identity and move to another, and that's especially important when we're working from home and working home are tending to blur together. So that's kind of interesting. And then there's this one. Take some time to check in with people as people first rather than simply getting on with the task at hand. I feel like I enjoy the good fortune in many of my meetings to be with people who would do this sort of just out of the way that they operate. They would want to go around the Zoom circle first and go, how are people doing? How are you holding up? Okay, now we have this agenda we need to get through. I think that's important. And finally, and this one sort of starts to turn us toward the fourth century part of what we're going to explore this morning. Some experts suggest going, quote, old school and writing a letter to let someone know that you care and that you're thinking about them. You know, there are people in our household that are doing this with friends. But can I just say that almost everything we do is old school compared to a Zoom meeting? I hadn't really thought about this before because it's so pervasive, but the technological oomph that's required for an online virtual face-to-face meeting, that technology didn't even exist until the 1990s, and it wasn't really until the early 2000s that it was common enough to be available to sort of ordinary folks, other than the military, let's say. Now, I am terrible at math, but these are nice round numbers. I can even work with these. And those numbers suggest that we've been working with this Zoom medium for less than 20 years. Now, depending how you define your terms, humans have been around for about 200,000 years, and we've been finding ways to communicate face-to-face for most of that time. And we wonder why we're finding the sudden immersive experience of Zoom meetings exhausting? Like, let's just think about this in evolutionary terms for a moment. Just from that vantage point, we are not equipped for this, and we can't get equipped for it nearly as fast as we're being exposed to it. Now, why are we talking about this at the table on a Sunday morning? Is this a sudden frantic attempt at cultural relevance? too late. No, it isn't. In fact, I'm about to get so old school that we might all be wondering for the next bit if Tim has sort of lost his grip on which century he's actually in, despite the fact that he's talking to his phone in an empty room. So, here we go. An old school story from the 4th century, from the early Middle Ages, or if you're a Middle Ages scholar and you find that offensive because it suggests your pet period of history is this little tiny bit squished in between some other important bits, the medieval period, all right? So, there's a monk and Christian mystic named John Cassian, who authored a work called The Institutes at that time, so 4th century. And a hugely significant first contribution from a religious leader whose influence can actually pretty easily be traced right down to today, at least in the realm of Christian ideas. And in that collection, he tells the story of a monk named Abba Paul. Now, Paul was one of what we would now call the desert fathers or mothers. This is a group of people who looked around at their society in the 4th century, saw it as something that was basically getting in the way of their spiritual formation, and they left. They actually moved out. They went to the desert, to the actual, so it's not a metaphor, they went to actually go live in the desert to pursue lives of prayer and contemplation. And one of the things that they had to really wrestle with in that process was how to understand the relationship between things we might call spiritual work. And I'm going to make a bit of an artificial distinction here, because I think in our ideal human experience, these things all become so integrated that they're hard to tease apart. But for the purposes of exploring the idea, they had to really wrestle with how to understand the relationship between spiritual work, in their case, reading, contemplation, and prayer, and physical work, so what they did with their bodies, the work of their hands. And Paul, like lots of other desert monks, wove baskets as he prayed. So his whole day was prayer, reading, and contemplation. That was his work, but he wove baskets all day as well. And as far as living goes, he subsisted on food from his own garden and some date palms that he gathered that grew in the region. And he had a bit of a unique circumstances, as Cassian tells the story. Abba Paul lived deep in the desert. And in fact, he lived so deep in the desert that the nearest towns or cities or even habitable land was about a 7-day journey away. And that meant that even if he could find someone he could pay to transport him to the city, it would cost him more to get there than what he would get for the work that he made and sold. So he's pretty cut off, but he still decides to collect palm fronds and to weave baskets. And he makes sure he does a full day's physical work as if it was his means of support. And then, and this is where the story, I think, gets kind of what? When he had a year's worth of baskets in his cave, he burned up all the baskets that he had so carefully toiled over for the entire year. Now, what's that about? Well, here's some possibilities. One possibility is that Abba Paul is a kind of a super monk. He's someone who deeply recognizes that the prayers that he recites during his physical work are more valuable than anything he could make. That's one possibility. Another possibility is he's a prototypical performance artist, and he is methodically destroying the baskets he has made to demonstrate that the process of making them is more important than the product. Yeah. Or maybe he's just a misguided eccentric and he really has nothing to say to anyone whose reason is functioning even sort of somewhat well. Well, the fellow monk who wrote the story down suggests something else entirely. He writes that this annual burning had a greater purpose, that it, quote, aided Abba Paul in purging his heart, firming his thoughts, persevering in his spiritual disciplines, and helping to renew his desire to care about matters of the spirit. Now, that last one I want to just focus on for a few moments. Cassian uses a particular term there for the loss of spiritual desire or motivation. He uses the term acedia, not a common word these days. I'm not going to really get into the word. I'm not going to word nerd on you on that one. And the reason is because it's a very complex term with a very involved history. In fact, it's a word that disappeared from our language for a while and is making a return. And those are interesting terms too. Anyway, the short version is that Cassian is talking about what it's like and how to respond when we feel like we've lost our ability to care about things that we might call spiritual. We might even want to care. We might have this sense that we ought to, and that might not come from outside of us. That might come from inside of us. We might have an interior oughtness. I ought to care about spiritual things. But even when we try, we find we just can't do it. That's sort of a short definition of acedia. And one of the things that can make that idea complicated for us to consider in this day and age is that it can sound a lot like what we would now call depression. It could sound like it's a description of how we feel after one too many Zoom meetings, like we should care and we just don't, we just can't. But it's unique in the sense that it's profoundly and centrally about something spiritual. It's not the sort of thing, acedia is not the sort of thing that tends to respond well to medication or counseling or therapy, all potentially positive ways of engaging with depression, for instance. And I think one way to look at it is to regard it as an attempt to put language to what is going on inside of us and in the wider realm of the spiritual, however we experience that or think about that, when we feel like our insides are starting to give way to things like restless boredom or frantic escapism or commitment phobia or the kind of despair that just drains us of our energy and vitality. These are the kind of things that are things that have to do with our spirit, among other aspects of us as persons. Maybe we could say that it's what we're trying to describe when we would say something like, I just don't care anymore. Well, one of the things that is worth noting about acedia is that, like depression, it can ebb and flow. And I don't think most of us want to live with the flow of this. If that's what we're experiencing, we want it to go away. We want it to recede. We want it to be an ebb tide in our lives, not a flood tide. And so, as with Zoom meeting problems, what to do? Should we take a literal page from Kasian's account of Abba Paul's practice and, you know, have a laptop burning ceremony? Maybe we should have a select all delete moment with our year's work. Oh man, I can feel the shudders coming at me through the internet. We're just trying to imagine that feeling that you get, you know, when you can't find one file, you've lost a computer file. Take that feeling and multiply it by a year's worth of work and hitting delete, and then, you know, no. So, no, that is not what I am talking about. What can we learn from the things that Kasian said, this burning of Abba Paul's work accomplished? Well, let's just go back to that phrase that I quoted from him a little earlier and just take a look at the first thing that he says it accomplished. He says that Abba Paul's choice to burn up his year's work every year purged his heart. Here's a little word moment. To purge is to rid someone or something of an unwanted quality, condition, or feeling. And no, I did not make that definition up because it conveniently fit the point I wanted to make. When I actually started to parse this statement, that's what the word purge means. To rid someone or something of an unwanted quality, condition, or feeling. Fair to say? You decide? Maybe things like that bundle of feelings we get from too many hours in Zoom meetings? Maybe like the feeling of dread that we get when we have to try to tamp down what happens inside of us when we see that notice on our calendar that reminds us that today is another day when we won't get to see someone that we really miss. Now, I can't ask him in person, and the writings that we have are not autobiographical, so I am speculating, but I suspect that Abba Paul didn't burn that first year's work without seriously asking, what does my work mean to me? And I would suggest that clearly that cave full of baskets meant a great deal to him. Now, that might sound a little counterintuitive. I mean, he burned them all up, right? But try thinking of it this way. Here's a person who takes his spirituality seriously. He's made some radical commitments to pursue matters of the heart. He has gone against the prevailing religious grain. He has gone upstream from the crowd. He's given up some of the comforts from believing what the prevailing norms would say are right belief. He hasn't just risked rejection. He has chosen a path that is clearly about not fitting in. It's not that he has no company, but he doesn't have much. He's certainly not in the majority. And if he treats his work a bit differently than others might think he should, if he treats it in ways that mean he won't let it become the ultimate thing in his world, if he doesn't let it take over his life, it's not because he doesn't value it. And this is where the tension lives. If he didn't see value in his work, he wouldn't do what he did. Because he doesn't have to. He lives from his garden and the date palms. He's not selling his baskets. So what he's doing is taking something that he values and that he invests in all day, every day, and he's radically acknowledging that it is not the last word in his life. to me, that's really intriguing. I think that in that regard, it almost seems like the idea that I mentioned a moment ago regarding performance art might be pointing in a helpful direction. It's like Abba Paul is acting something out. He's dramatizing something, and he's doing it to purge his spirit of things that would otherwise rob him of his ability to care about deeper, more important things, even in the face of numbing, repetitive tasks. Well, I could be wrong, and since I can't get any feedback this way, I think, though, we've already tacitly agreed to not rush out and burn our laptops. Actually, if I was going to do that, I'm just the window that I can look out, if I just look off in this direction from where I am, looks out at a creek that's in flood right now. I wouldn't burn mine. I'd just walk to the edge of the creek and just toss it in. But we agreed we're not going that way. Okay, so let's see. What else? In lieu of that, or instead of that, perhaps, it might not be a bad idea. In fact, it might even be a very good, spiritually invigorating idea to seriously consider what place our work holds in our lives. And having our work disrupted, having been jostled hard enough by a pandemic that we've been forced out of our sometimes comfortable patterns and values regarding work, that experience might have within it the potential to accomplish something similar to Abba Paul's annual bonfire. Those kind of experiences might be just the thing that can send us back to our quests, back to our explorations, back to our questions, back to even our commitments, with a renewed sense of purpose and a fresh energy, determined not to do our daily work without consciously attending to what it costs us and how we value it. It might be just what we need to clear away some of the debris of the everyday and make a fresh spiritual start, one that includes the work of our hands, but that isn't ruled by the work of our hands. Maybe those desert fathers and mothers, maybe those people who made radical spiritual choices at a point in history when the economy wasn't exactly booming either, maybe they still have something to say to us today. Well, we all have to make those kind of decisions for ourselves, don't we? But it might be worth thinking about. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being together. It's been good to be with you as much as we're able. Peace to you. Bye for now.